Steiner, and welcome this afternoon. Later in the program, we're going to talk about homelessness and our students. There are thousands of students in the state of Maryland who are homeless. At least 1.5 million, perhaps millions more, that are homeless in the United States of America. But that's later in the program. First, I want to bring you an interview that we did this morning on North Avenue with Dr. Andres Alonzo, CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools, where we touched on many things, including his closing of schools, merging schools, and decimating the staff on North Avenue to put them back in the schools. What does it all mean for the future of our schools? So stay tuned here for our interview with Dr. Andres Alonzo. Then we'll be back to talk about homelessness and our students. We are sitting at North Avenue and our school system headquarters here in Baltimore, talking with Dr. Andres Alonzo, who, of course, is the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools, who were in the papers all last week because of budget cuts that happened and his decisions to trim the staff at the North Avenue headquarters by 179 employees and saying they could then apply for 50 jobs that are opening up in a new way. And Andres Alonzo, welcome. Always a pleasure to see you and talk to you in your backyard today.
Thank you, sir.
So let's talk about this. What does it say in a broad sense that you can lay off 179 people? People have always talked about bloated bureaucracies. Is that the case here? Has this bureaucracy always been bloated? And now you're getting around to trimming it to where it needs to be? Is that your philosophical point here?
I don't think the bureaucracy is bloated at this point. I mean, over 2 years, I will have terminated or ended 489 positions, which is a third of what I originally found. Mm-hmm. I mean, at this point, it's not about bureaucratic bloat. It's simply about making tough decisions about where do we want the dollars to be. And in a context where our general funds only increased by $1 million from the state, and we want to hold the schools harmless, the dollars, either in terms of cuts, either come from the central office or they come from the schools. And my strong belief is that they cannot come from the schools. That's where the kids are.
But isn't this also part of your own pedagogic philosophy about how school systems should run? Because people have had your job many times over in my time here in Baltimore covering schools and is working in the schools as well back in the 70s and 80s. People have tried decentralization before, and it has not worked. People have tried centralization before. It has not worked. So I'm saying this is more than just you simply cutting positions, it seems. It seems like a whole move in terms of how you think schools should function.
Absolutely. Schools should function with autonomy, and they should function with the resources to make the decisions about what needs to happen in programs. Central office tend to be much larger than they need to be, and when you put lots of people in positions, what they do is they try to hoard responsibility and control. That's the nature of organizations. But in this particular moment in time, having cut 310 positions last year and now cutting 179 positions, if I ever have to come to this discussion, Mark, it's not about bloat. It's really about making hard choices. Now, in this case, our general funds only grew by $1 million. We want to keep the schools harmless in terms of their budgets, and the pie is not expanding. Therefore, as I cut the slices, I want the schools to keep the same slice or have a larger slice. And that can only happen if Central grows smaller. Also, it's, you know, every time that we do something, it's an opportunity to rethink how we do business. And clearly, part of what we want to do is have a central office that has extraordinary skills, that is dynamic, that think of its role not as administration and not as control, but as guidance, support, and holding schools accountable.
The schools that you closed and the consolidation of schools was probably as big, if not bigger, news than telling 179 employees don't have jobs, though 50 may remain employed if they are accepted for new positions and new teams you're creating.
Let me correct you on the facts. We eliminated not 179 positions. We eliminated, I believe, 240 positions. Then we are proposing the creation of 60 positions that are going to be in support of the school. So the net elimination of positions is 179.
Well, can people who have lived in a bureaucracy that long actually function in teams of four that go to schools that are being evaluated by principals rather than the other way around and get a job done, or do you have to find new people to do that?
I think many people can function and flourish since the bureaucracy sometimes works against the people who are there, and many people will not be able to function and flourish, and they will have to look for other jobs. The other fact is that they're not just the positions in the networks that will be available for people to apply to. Schools are constantly creating positions and having positions vacated in them. So people in the central office will be able to, of course, be able to apply for positions that become open in the schools. Some of them administrative positions, others teaching positions. And I have said from day one, if people are interested in sustainable jobs, the safest positions are in the schools, because I'm not cutting the schools. I know that I'm going to have to keep cutting the central office, because unless our budgets expand, if I don't want to cut the school, I'm going to need to cut the central office.
Politically in the past, there's often been an oppositional relationship between the head of the school and the teachers' union. Here it seems that the tension lives between the head of the school, being you, and Mr. Giddings, I think I have the name, and Pizzazz, the group that represents the administrators, which is where the cuts are taking place. He's saying that you're going after his union, basically, and that failing schools should not be closed, they don't need closure, they need help. This is where the line seems to be drawn between you and that union.
It's very interesting, because at the beginning it was all about, you're not getting along with the teachers' union. And lo and behold, now, I love teachers. Teachers love me. And this is what I said at the beginning. There's no tension with teachers, right? There's no tension between me and administrators. I love administrators as well. And let's not confuse
unions. Dr. Alonso, there's no tension between you and the administrators and their union? There's a lot of tension between you and the administrators' union.
Absolutely not. In the following way. First of all, there is tension within the union.
Mm-hmm.
As in, you have principals, assistant principals, central office employees, all coexisting under one union. Well, part of the reason why I have to redo the central office is because the principals are telling me that the central office is not working well enough for them. And who cuts administrative positions in the schools? Principals, who are part of the union. So it is clearly at a time of hard choices, there is tension all around, number one. Secondly, my goal is not to get along with anyone. My goal is to ensure that schools have the support that they need so that every single child can be in the best setting. So that's what I'm going to do. It's not a question of tension. I love my administrators. I'm just going to do what I need to do. And maybe prior superintendents did not experience or approach the job in the same way. I think that they did. It's maybe dramatized in a different way now because of the scope and speed of the reform proposals. The other aspect, which has to do with what needs to happen with schools.
That's where we're going now, right?
If it takes 4 years to improve a school, the old-fashioned way, but it takes 1 year to create a new setting in the new way, and you have children who are in places that have been failing over time, to me, it's a very logical way of approaching the work. You have schools that the parents have abandoned, as in some of the schools that were closing began with 900 kids. They're down to 500 kids now, as our enrollment is now increasing. So if parents are telling me that they don't want to go to a particular building, and if the building is failing, then something has to change, and it has to change gradually, not gradually, like radically, so that kids don't lose 1, 2, 3 years as we, administrators and teachers in central office, struggle to get it right, having struggled for a decade, 4 decades to get it right. That's one part of it. The second piece is that sometimes we structure schools to fail.
What does that mean?
As in, you have a school like You know, the schools in the Marshall complex, for example, Banks and Thurgood Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall
or
right.
A school like LaMel, for example. There are schools that have 45 to 50% of their population, of their enrollment, are overage kids. You have huge numbers of special education kids in those schools. You have kids that are 2 years overage. Why? Because we have a structure of choice in our schools where some kids can get into some schools. Those schools fill, and then the kids, usually the kids who are most at risk, end up choosing places that are their third or fourth choice, or we put them there, as opposed to the possibility of creating schools that allow for a wider system of choice or expanding high achieving schools that are tremendously desired. Digital Harbor gets 1,700 applications for 250 seats. And then you have another school that gets 50 applications for 200 seats.
Which school is that?
As some of the schools that we just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So it is, to me, nonsensical if I have the opportunity creatively to expand Digital Harbor to which a school everybody wants to get into, for me not to do so and put those kids there, as opposed to out of this, you know, fitting feet in cement kind of approach to the work, you know, continue working with a school that, you know, these schools have been zero base. They have had new principals. They have had millions of dollars over time in terms of school improvement funds, and nothing seems to happen. And part of the reason why nothing seems to happen is that at some level, I think that they're structured to fail. So the way in which I approach the work is the following. If parents want the school, I need to work with the school. If enrollment is growing, that's a good business. I need to work with that school. If I see progress in terms of outcomes, then there's something good going on there. I need to work with that school. If none of those things is happening, then you know what? I need to work with a school while that school is open, because that's my responsibility to all kids. But if I make a decision to close it because certain things can happen in a faster way through a different arrangement, then that's what I'm going to do.
So we have schools that are closing. Let's say one that has kind of used to have a wonderful reputation, has a long history, like LaMel.
How long ago did it have the history?
When I was in junior high school.
God, was I even born then?
You may not have been.
Okay.
When I was a kid, this was the school where all the black middle class sent their kids. That's what they went through. It was a large portion. And it was a shiny school with an incredible program.
And why has that school lost 400 kids in the last 2 years?
Because it is what they used to call my junior high school is what that's become. They used to call my junior high school Little Alcatraz. That's become Little Alcatraz. That's why.
And if I can expand a school like Connections, which is highly desired, and put it there, and if I can put a Diploma Plus building and put it there, and if I can create two or three transformation schools, which the parents want to go to, and put it in the surrounding area, then what's the story?
So
the bottom line for me is that it is not about the institutions. It is not about the people in the institutions. It is not about history. I came to this city to change the history, not to bow in front of a history that has not worked for kids.
Well, some of the schools we have here that are changing are in the hands of organizations that are national groups, not necessarily local groups. Let's talk about that. I'm curious who they are. Let's say Diploma Plus.
Diploma Plus is an organization out of Baltimore that has been, Boston, that has been extraordinarily successful in terms of educating overage, undercredited kids.
But more than just a GED.
Correct. They take children who traditionally either drop out or graduate with an inferior diploma or a GED, and they send vast numbers of these kids to community or four-year colleges. They have an extraordinary record of success. Some of the schools that we're creating, however, are local institutions. I mean, Blue for Drew Jameson, NACA, North Urapawood Community. These are all institutions that are NAF, the National Academy Foundation. These are all local institutions. And to me, it's not about the local versus the external. It's about, is there a capacity on the part of the partner to respond to the needs of community and kids? There's a school, for example, that we're going to open called One Bright Ray, hopefully in the southeast of Baltimore. That's an area of the city where we have huge numbers of English language learners arriving. Without formal education sometimes, or sometimes with a great formal education in the native language, but no English whatsoever. They come in at the age of 16, 17. There's no place for them. So we're going to, because we have not created a local institution to serve them, we're going to bring a partner who has experience in that kind of education. And we're going to create an institution that hopefully serves to keep in school and really trampoline a section of the population that, you know, I could have been one of those kids if I had come to this country. Now, if I had come to Baltimore right now, there might not have been a program for me. Therefore, there is a huge responsibility to find the expertness wherever it's available.
A few quick questions here. Diploma Plus, is it a for-profit or non-profit company?
It's a nonprofit.
That one of the schools that is being affected by the closures and by amalgamating different schools in places is another school that has a long history. The question is, I'm going to ask you, is whether the school has outlived its usefulness.
Which one?
Paquin.
We're not closing
Paquin. No, you're not closing Paquin, but Paquin was started in 1966. I worked with it 30 years ago. But many young girls who become pregnant in our city schools end up staying in general populations and graduating.
Because it's a different world.
It's a different world.
Yeah.
So I'm asking you, do you think schools like the Paquin School have outlived their usefulness as an institution?
I think that, well, it's a program already.
Right.
And it will remain a program. And part of the reason why it will remain a program is because if you have 40, 50 children who feel that this is what they need, then it's my responsibility to provide it. I mean, I'm not a person who approaches these questions ideologically.
Right.
So it's an abstraction, a hypothesis that in a hypothetical that I have no interest in arguing, in answering. Many places these schools are closing. I'm not closing Paquin. I am keeping the program within the bounds of its size, as in you have a school, a building with 400 seats
and 50 girls.
And at any point in time, you walk in and there are 50 girls.
Right.
And those 50 girls, if they want to be there, they should be there because it's all about choice, remember? But that doesn't mean that they, like everyone else in the city, they have an empire. The so much of, and look, I said it at the last board meeting when that, you know, every time I talk about co-locating a school, somebody jumps as though I am violating some extraordinary norm. That norm can only come when adults think of the world as though the world is for them and not for children. Because it's a school system. All the children are children in Baltimore City. There's no such thing as anybody owning a building. I mean, I said it. I signed the checks, folks. So my name is on that check as long as I'm CEO here. The notion that any administrator or any community partner or anyone is saying this building is for us and not for them is antithetical to the way I work. So if I have a larger program, Rising Star, which cannot expand even though there is tremendous demand for it, and I have this largely empty building, and both programs have an alternative approach, it makes sense to put them there.
One final thing. The rest of our program today is going to be discussing a report that was put out in an online newspaper about homelessness and students. And I want to ask you a question about that, your approach to this and your thoughts to this. There could be, we don't know yet, there could be thousands of students like this, because homelessness has a broad definition. You could be living in a shelter, you could be living in a car, could be living in an abandoned house, or it could mean 2, 3, 4, 5 families are stuck in a teeny apartment trying to survive.
Yeah.
And so it's a huge problem in the city. It's growing every day. And I want to know your thoughts on this and how it affects education and what's your role in all of this? You're not Andres Alonso, but you, the school system.
Well, the school system is I believe, the institution in society that is working for the kids. As in the case of many of those kids, something has fallen awry. Either the economy has caused the parents to be displaced, or there's been a breakdown in the family unit that has led to this situation. And for 7 hours a day, there's a place where the kids have a structure that is predictable, where people are getting paid to serve them, basically. So we have a role in terms of identifying what the issues are and bringing all the other social agencies to the table in order to respond to the needs of individual kids. Many times we don't know that the kids are homeless, because often families are mistrustful of the governmental agencies, and sometimes homelessness means, for example, that they no longer live in the zone that the
right,
school
exactly,
is.
Exactly.
So quite often things are going on, and unless you have extraordinarily dedicated staff in the school who knows the kids intimately and are able to spot something. And you know, kids are resilient, so they don't always let you know. You know, the schools are not structured to capture that kind of information. But to the extent that we can, we should be at the core of the conversation about what needs to happen. There is money in the stimulus package that Congress just passed for intervention in the education of the homeless. And one of the things that we're doing is looking at what it means in terms of Baltimore City. We have been working far more closely than ever before with social services, so that we just signed a memorandum of agreement about the sharing of information. They will have access to our emergency cards as a way of allowing them, in case of having to transfer custody of a child, to try to do it within the family rather than having to send the children to group homes, which we want to avoid as much as possible. So we're working with the social agencies in terms of data sharing so that we get our act together in terms of the service of these kids.
Dr. Andres Alonso, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to see you in your backyard.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was the conversation I had with Dr. Andres Alonso earlier today at his office on North Avenue, of course, CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. We concluded by talking about homeless children in our public schools. Melody Simmons, who's a reporter here at WEA and works with us here at the Center for Emerging Media, often talks about homelessness and has written a story, talked about writing stories about homelessness in our students, and wrote a wonderful story, an investigative voice, which you can see online right now. And we're going to go to a break here, talk more about that when we return. And when we return, we're going to talk about homelessness among our students in our public schools throughout the state of Maryland. As we go to break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. Stay with us and come back with your thoughts. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. 1-800-273-8255. As I said, as we're going to break, we're going to talk about homelessness and our students in the state of Maryland. Melody Simmons, who works with WEA and with our Mark Steiner show in the Center for Emerging Media, was talking for a long time about the problem of homelessness that she was going to explode among our public school students. She wrote a article about that on Investigative Voice, which is a new website put up by former Examiner reporters. They're doing a wonderful job. You can see her article right there, or go to steinershow.com and link to it. And that was the basis for our discussion today. The reason we're doing this discussion was the work she was doing in investigating this story. We're joined in studio by Francine Hahn, who is staff attorney for the Homeless Persons Representation Project. Betty Schultz is a pediatric nurse practitioner who treats homeless children and works for healthcare for the homeless at Mercy Hospital. Annette White is the homeless services liaison of the Baltimore City Public Schools and runs programs and shelters for after-school homework assistance. And Louise Fink is director of interagency support for the city schools. And good to have you all with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Many of you may be teachers who teach children who are homeless. Many of you may have been homeless yourselves, and many of you experienced this. Maybe you're homeless at this moment and have views and ideas on this. You can call us at 410-319-8888, write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, or you can log on to Facebook and go to Mark Steiner, and we're looking at Facebook all during the course of the hour, and take your thoughts and comments via Facebook, the wonders of modern technology. So let's talk about the extent of this problem. It seems to me that when we say that one out of 50 children in the United States of America are homeless, it's a phenomenal number, one out of 50 children. At least 1.5 million children in this country are homeless. Thousands in Baltimore, maybe. Thousands around the state. It may be many more than we realize, because the way we define homelessness, it's not the way many other people define homelessness, and many people who are homeless don't want to be defined as such. So this is just a problem that I think is exploding. Why don't we get the perspective from our schools first, start with Louise Fink, then go to Annette White.
Currently, in the Baltimore City Schools, we've identified 1,200 students as homeless who have self-identified. They're students who are receiving transportation, who are receiving free lunches, who are receiving uniforms for us, and have chosen to identify themselves as homeless. We actually believe it's just a tip of the iceberg, because we believe that many people don't want to identify them as homeless. Our definition of homeless includes anybody who really doesn't have a fixed, permanent place to sleep at night. They might be going from relative to relative. They may be going from friend to friend. They may be in a shelter. They may be in a car. They may be all kinds of places. And we do not require people to identify themselves as homeless. We just provide services when they do that identification to us.
And that way, tell me about your experience in the schools working with homeless children.
Okay. my responsibility is to coordinate the homeless education program day-to-day that operates in our schools, in the shelters, and the community. We use various definitions based on McKinney-Vento law that says these children are homeless, as well as what Louise identified. A couple other identifications we use is that those kids that are living in public and privately operating emergency and transitional shelters, as well as those kids that are unaccompanied youth who are not under the supervision of an adult, can be considered as homeless, as well as those kids who are awaiting foster care placement, meaning those kids that are not in foster care but waiting to be placed in foster care. We also provide several services, or many services, to the students. We see that they get their free lunch every day. They're entitled to free lunch, irregardless of a free lunch application. If they're living a mile in elementary school from the school, they are entitled to transportation for elementary. Middle school and high schools, a mile and a half from the school. We also provide them with vouchers for clothing if it's identified that that's a barrier. We want to remove all barriers that keep those kids from attending school. Mm-hmm. And clothing sometimes, any barrier that hinders them from attending school, we attempt to remove.
So now, one of the things when Louise Fink talked about kids who are in free lunch programs, one of the things I've been reading a lot about lately and seeing is that there are a lot of middle-class families, families who have parents working 8-hour days who are now homeless, who are doubling, tripling up in people's homes. And we don't usually, they're not usually the free lunch kids. These are kids who, families may be, father may be an electrician, mother may be working someplace, but they're out of work, and kids are out of a home. So the definition of homelessness seems to be growing in America.
It's growing.
Francine?
The definition of homelessness has not grown. That's remained the same, and that's defined by federal law.
The popular definition, I should say. Yeah.
But that, I think, you know, what you just mentioned, Mark, it speaks to the importance of the identification of homeless children and families, because there has to be a more proactive approach in identifying students. And that can be done by school systems by adding a question to the registration form. Are you enrolling your child due to a loss of housing, to a withdrawal form? Are you withdrawing your child due to a loss of housing? That yes, no checkoff question can help identify homeless children, in much greater numbers than just waiting for them to self-identify.
Do you think we're underestimating the number of homeless kids in the city?
Absolutely.
Now, why do you say that? By how much? How much do you think we're really underestimating the numbers of children in the city, or people, period, who are homeless?
Well, first, our family and children shelter space is inadequate. So we don't even have enough shelter space for them. So the easiest way to identify homeless children is through the shelter system. So that's one problem. Second, if the system in Baltimore City schools is to have families self-identify, well, many families are not going to, because there is a fear of other government agencies that that may come in and intervene and maybe cause disruption in the family unit, such as the Department of Social Services, as an example.
People are terrified that someone's going to come in and take their children away from them.
Right.
Right.
Right. Okay. So that's an example. And so I think that our job as advocates is to help create this very important conversation to bring down that level of fear, to make families feel safe, to understand that that parents and children are experiencing trauma, and we need to deal with these issues.
What are you trying to say here, Annette?
Mark, we do have a point person in every school, middle, high school, and elementary, and that's the social workers and guidance counselors who identify our homeless kids for us. We also have an online tracking system where they enter them once they report that they're homeless or identify them as homeless, and that's what keeps our count rolling from day to day for us.
Now, one of the things that I was so fascinated by in the article, Betty Schultz, you were in the article that Melody Simmons wrote for the Investigative Voice. And you talked about the state of homeless children medically. And I think that one of the things that really is one of the issues that we really have to figure out how to address are the medical and psychological issues facing homeless kids in our schools, and also how that affects their behavior in schools. So talk a bit about your experience in working with homeless kids as a pediatric nurse.
A huge barrier to the schools is the children's health. If they're not well, they can't learn. If they're not well, they can't go to school. And I've seen that, and there's articles that you can read about homeless children that state that homeless children's health is so much worse even than children that are living housed in poverty. We have problems with asthma, especially in this city, which is an extremely high percentage of children that have asthma. They have asthma exacerbations that happen many more times than the average house child. Skin conditions, which are a lot higher. Upper respiratory tract infections, gastrointestinal infections. And all of these in a house child can be taken care of with rest or the proper diet or proper medications. With the homeless child, number one, if they're in a shelter, a lot of the times they don't have a place to be during the day unless they're in school. But if they're not in school, they don't have a place to rest. They don't have a place to get the proper nutrition. They don't have a place to get the proper hydration. It's many factors when you look at children that are homeless. Doubled up children are in congregate shelters. They're with many other people. So the infectious problem is great. They just hand it over one to the other to the other. So when there's one child sick in the shelter, then they're all sick.
So the question I have, then we open the phones here at 410-319-8888, your thoughts on homelessness and our children. And I can see that Louise Fink wants to say something, and I'd like to bring you in, because I'm really curious about what it is we have to tackle, what we do. I mean, this is a problem that's not going to lessen, but if the economic indicators are correct, it's only going to steepen and widen and affect more and more of the children in our schools.
Right, and we've seen it affecting more and more of the children in the schools, and we are really very careful. One of the things we've done in Baltimore City Schools is we've introduced a universal breakfast program. So everybody gets breakfast in the city schools now.
No matter what economic status they come from.
No matter what economic status they come from, because a lot of children were skipping breakfast, and we find the children learn better when they have breakfast. For many of our homeless kids, they get their two meals in the day. They get their breakfast and they get their lunch in the city schools. And that, it makes a major, major difference for them in terms of nutrition, in terms of being able to develop. We actually have the kind of form that was mentioned earlier, where you're supposed to identify. The problem is we don't coerce people. If people don't want to tell us they're homeless, we don't force them to. And sometimes we've had principals and other people who've gone on to talk to parents and said, you know, if you will tell us you're homeless, we can get you uniforms for your children, we can put them on the lunch program. But a lot of people are very, very proud and don't want to admit where they are.
What about, I mean, how we address this? I mean, when Baltimore is getting $9.5 million from HUD, and there's a $21.5 million to fund homeless services in the stimulus package, that's almost $31 million we're talking about coming to the city of Baltimore. So what do we do? Where does that money go? How much of it goes to our children? How does it affect their lives? And what are you recommending, let's say, Francine Hahn, be done with that money?
Rapid rehousing. That is a program where we put homeless families immediately into permanent housing. We don't put homeless families through the emergency shelter transitional housing process. We put them into permanent housing and bring supportive services to that family.
And how realistic is it that that can happen, and how quickly can that happen?
Some of that is happening now, in small numbers. It is happening now. So we need to broaden that and have more of that housing available to families.
And I think about this. Please, I want you to come right in here. Then we're going to open the phones, Betty Schultz, because I must have this disclaimer here in the sense that I serve on the Mayor's Commission to End Homelessness. Sister Helen Amos is the chair of from Mercy Hospital. So I've been kind of reading all the material and wrestling with this with people. And the question I have, and I'll have for the commission as well, is why should we wait 15 years? Why does it take 15 years to put enough homes and places for the homeless to live in to have a decent way of living? That we'll deal with that in a minute. But you want to say something here, Betsy Schultz.
I do.
Betty Schultz.
One of the focuses in Baltimore City has been on single adults when we talk about this rapid rehousing,
right,
or housing first, as its other name is. And one of the issues is trying to end homelessness in 10 years. And if you're looking at just housing single adults, then that's not going to end homelessness. I really feel that you've got to get at the children and you've got to give them some stability in order to help them be able to become productive citizens later on. And it must have intense case management services in that housing. Right now, they are doing some rapid rehousing with families. And the case management services that they have, they don't have enough. They just don't have enough time or enough of the case managers to really work with those families. It has to be intense. And since we're talking about education, there has to be some educational component in this case management system to really help these children to attain what they need to become productive citizens. If you look at income versus education, there's a direct correlation. And you need to give intense educational services to these children, or they're going to just keep being homeless. I've been doing this for 18 years, and I'm now seeing third-generation families being homeless, and we've got to stop it.
And the homeless children are often the ones who may act out because of their medical and psychological issues from being homeless. And that fills the classrooms. That I know Andres Alonso is trying to build schools for kids who are two or three grades behind where they should be, but that fills that. I mean, it's a huge problem that could really, I don't understand the magnitude of this problem and how deeply it's growing. And I want to hear what our listeners think. You just heard Betty Schultz, who's a pediatric nurse practitioner who works with homeless children and works for healthcare for the homeless. Francine Hahn is attorney at the Homeless Persons Representation Project and former Baltimore City Schools. Annette White is the homeless services liaison for our school system and runs programs in shelters for after-school homework assistance. Louise Fink is the Director of Interagency Support for our city schools. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts here on the air? Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to Facebook and let me see what you're saying. Let's go to Russ in East Baltimore. You're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ.
Your guest. Mark, and listening to the program today, I'm kind of reminded of the blind man and the elephant. I think that by focusing on each small aspect, we kind of miss the overarching problem. This is a systemic failure, and I think at some point, groups like you have today and others are going to have to come together and challenge capitalism. And by that, what I'm trying to get at is, I heard Dr. Alonzo in the earlier segment saying that his general fund increased by $1 million. Now, just earlier on the news, I heard the president talking about AIG dealing out $165 million in bonuses to failed executives and workers. That just seems kind of out of proportion. Homelessness is growing in an earlier report on today. There was a report about in Sacramento how they have people camped out in tents along the American River, and it went from about 13 tents to now over 400. So I see this as a systemic failure that needs to be addressed by let's take a look at the system, because the system is either broken in the sense that we've got our priorities wrong, that the money's not getting, it's not enough money to do things, or that the money that's there is not getting to the right places. And I just wanted to throw that out and see how your panel reacted to that.
Francine Hahn, why don't you go right ahead? Okay, you're about to react to it, so please do.
Yeah. Well, that certainly is a big challenge, but I think a place to begin is to look at Maryland's 10-year plan to end homelessness. It mentions children and families, but it does not give specific goals or action steps on how to address the problem of children and family homelessness, and how to end it. So I think that's a great place when you talk about systemic failure, how to address that. Because if it's coming from the state down, then action will be taken. When we talk about money and budgets, with the stimulus money, there. In addition to HUD money, there's also federal welfare money coming down, or what we call TANF funds. And we can look at that money as an opportunity. In the welfare program, there are work programs, work activities that are required. We need to look at those programs in a meaningful way that will help homeless families have meaningful job training that will help them work their way out of homelessness. There's also homelessness prevention program money in the TANF, in the welfare money. And so we also need to be looking at how to use that most effectively to help pay for security deposits, eviction prevention, and things like that. We can also repurpose the money that we, the federal dollars that we have, and get it towards the programs that will help families and children.
Let me reopen the phones here. 410-319-8888. As we look at homelessness among our students in our public schools, let me say the public school system that has the highest number of homeless students that we have found so far is Prince George's County, not Baltimore City. And that says a great deal. It's a huge county. It's a county that has a huge middle class, working class population. And it's a problem that a county that's seen the largest rise in homelessness of any of our school systems. That says a great deal, and maybe we'll have to look at that a little more closely. 410-319-8888. Leslie, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Leslie. I'm the director of the housing organization. We are actually Maryland's only housing organization for homeless youth. These are unaccompanied minors who are not part of the foster care system. And while money is critical, and I think Francine covered that quite nicely, Some of it is also just some legislative corrections, things like food stamps. Youth right now, they're legally eligible to get food stamps at 16 if they are on their own. But our system of bureaucrats, in essence, have denied them that right. Now, a young person could live with a friend in a stable environment and would probably be welcomed if they could provide a little bit of money, which food stamps could help support. Similarly, many teen youth are not allowed in shelters. So I'm talking about the older youth, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, who now we're breaking up the family because the shelters won't allow
them. Well, let me take a step back. What do you mean teenagers not allowed in shelters?
Boys.
Ask most of the, if you have a family with an adult, a teen male, the shelters, emergency shelters, will not allow the male to stay there.
And the logic for that is what?
I'm not the person to ask that.
What do you think the logic is?
I think the excuse is safety for the other residents, right, that you've got a large male who could be intimidating or in any way cause trouble. So they're denied access to the shelters. So.
Hold on one second, Leslie. Betty Schultz wants to jump in here. Betty, please go ahead.
Leslie, thanks for your comments.
Sure.
We know each other well. The older boys aren't invited into the shelters because some of the children in the shelters actually might be very close in age. So some of the female children, say, for example, you might have a child who's 16 or 17 years old. If you bring a 16 or 17-year-old male into that setting in a congregate shelter, there could be problems, and that's what they're looking at. And there are a lot of shelters that don't allow that. Also, the problem is if a 16 or 17-year-old girl has a baby, for example, she is not invited into the shelters because she's not 18 yet. So she has to go into the shelter with her mother. But so there's no place for her.
You know, and this leads to a whole other problem, that a different problem that people do not talk about in this city very much, and we tried to do a story on this a couple of years ago, maybe we'll try it again, which is that there may be hundreds of young people in the city of Baltimore who actually live in what I call like Lord of the Flies collectives. They live in abandoned houses together, mm-hmm, for self-protection. We're talking about kids who are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old and teenagers who are older, living in homes where they've rewired the electricity to make sure they have electricity in the house, and that they live in homes together in these kind of very strange worlds. And I mean, and what you're describing, you and the colleges now, Leslie, describing and not allowing teenagers who we're talking about, who may be the homeless children we're talking about in our schools, helps create this world of this kind of absurdist Lord of the Flies world where young people in the city are living in abandoned houses together. I mean, that's utter madness to let that happen, it seems to me.
Right, I agree, but there are some places that actually ban boys as young as 8. So we're talking about families being divided. It's difficult for
in
two
the city
parents.
There are shelters that ban boys as young as 8 years old,
and not only in the city. I mean, this
in
happens
the state,
in
the country,
around the state. Yeah, we yes.
We're not just picking on Baltimore City. This
we're
is
not
all
just
the
picking
state.
On Baltimore City.
No.
It's also difficult for two parent families to remain an intact family and stay in the shelter. So, you know, that destroys a child's confidence. That destroys a child's sense of place. Congregate shelter is prohibited in other places like New York City for families. You cannot have a family in a congregate shelter setting.
What does that mean?
Because it's not healthy to have 10 to 20 families sharing one large room
and
sleeping
congregate
on cots.
Shelter. Okay. Right.
So this is something that, you know, maybe we should be considering. Because we want to keep families intact. We want to have children with their parents, and if they're two-parent families.
So I'm going to ask our listeners again to rejoin us here at 410-319-8888. And if what you heard here gives you any sense of outrage or every sense of what we might and should do about the growing issue of homelessness among our young people especially and families, 410-319-8888. Annette White and Louise Fink come from Baltimore City Public Schools. Betty Schultz is a pediatric nurse practitioner working with healthcare for the homeless. Francine Hahn is an attorney with the Homeless Persons Representation Project. 410-319-8888. So on the way back to the phones here, I want to ask Louise and Annette, so how do you deal with that in our schools? How do you deal with, because clearly if you're an 8 to 14-year-old boy, let's say, not being allowed to go into a shelter, then coming to school the next day. I mean, this is fertile ground for behavior problems and other kinds of real issues these young people face. So what do you do to address that? I mean, in very kind of non-bureaucratic terms, what do you do personally to address it? What's out there?
We wouldn't know if the child has been eliminated from the shelter because those kids come through our registration process through the schools. However, we do have an attendance office. If that child's attendance is lacking, then that school would report them for non-attendance. But when parents register in the schools, they register all of their children, not just the girls or not just the children up to 8 or 12. They register everyone. So we would not know from the shelter unless someone told us and identified that for us that this child has not been omitted in the shelter. But let me also say that we do have 10 certified teachers that are tutoring in the evenings in 10 different shelters. And they, too, may pick it up. And if they pick it up, then they would bring it to our attention that several children have brothers and sisters who are not living in the shelter, maybe because of age, because we do get an attendance sheet and a roll from them every week as to who they have tutored during that period of time.
And
sometimes we don't know. There was a very fine article in the Sun papers several years ago about some older homeless children who were actually living in abandoned houses. And until they were identified in that article where they self-identified, nobody really knew that they were homeless. So they were coming to school every day, and they were doing their best. Some of the homeless children do come to school every day. It's the stable factor in their lives. So they come to school, they get their meals, they do their best to get their work done, they try to participate in some of the after-school activities. But it's back to the same thing again. We consider being homeless, not us in the school system,
right,
but our society considers homelessness a stigma. So unless somebody is really forced to self-identify themselves, they don't. And one of the things that was mentioned earlier about giving food stamps to children, I know of an instance where there's a young lady who is actually living doubled up, and that's how she's handling it. She's taking her food stamps, and she's using those food stamps to help the family with their groceries, and in return for that, she's being allowed to stay in the house with them.
410-319-8888. We're looking at the problem of homelessness among our young people in the state of Maryland. There are thousands of students in our public schools from throughout the state that are homeless. 410-319-8888. And Jane in Baltimore City, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point and also to ask one of your panelists to expand a little. I did work on the Civic Leadership Council on the plan to end homelessness and also on the work groups. And that plan actually, as Francine has pointed out, I think tremendously underestimated the number of homeless families or didn't address it as specifically as I think it should have done. However, I think there's a larger issue which speaks to why boys, for instance, of a certain age cannot be in the sheltering system and so on. Number one, we don't have enough beds or facilities to shelter the larger families in particular. And it's what needs to be underscored is the lack of affordable rentals. I mean, this is something I think that we really need to stress. I know we're talking about children in the school system,
mm-hmm,
but there's a chronic lack of affordable rentals, at least livable ones. And secondly, I wanted Betty to just mention, she did briefly mention that she is seeing, and I think Francine and the others, second and third generations, because this has been going on for a long time, and it's a poverty issue, and I just would like to hear Betty maybe very briefly speak to that issue.
It is a poverty issue, and of course homelessness is also episodic.
Thank you, Jane, for the question. Yes, we have the problems in the children that we're seeing over time are getting worse and worse, and one thing that I didn't mention earlier was the emotional disorders and the behavioral disorders that we see in the children. And when I first started to do this 18 years ago, there were very few mental health diagnoses, serious mental health diagnoses of the children. And now we're seeing serious mental health diagnoses and serious behavioral diagnoses in very young children. And that's because they have had no stability in their lives whatsoever. Early on, at least, maybe they had a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or whatever mm-hmm. who was stable in their lives. But now their parents are unstable. Their grandparents are unstable. They don't have any stability in their lives. So somehow this has to be broken. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but I know that this rapid rehousing with intense case management services and educational services really has to be dealt with. And looking at the system also, when you've got parents who are trying to get a job and they can't get child care vouchers until they have a job, how do they go for interviews? I mean, it's just a very little thing, but you have to think about all of these things when systematically.
410-31, I'm sorry, did you finish?
I'm finished. Thank you.
410-319-8888. Clara in Greenbelt, you're on the air.
I wanted to make a comment that came to mind. What about the state giving up some land, not necessarily, you know, actually handing it over, but using it and putting some of those FEMA trailers that are no longer in use for some families?
Well, I don't. FEMA trailers have the problems of their own, but I think that since they were toxic, but I think that there is an issue here. I think that the federal government may have to step in when it comes to temporary housing for the homeless. And this, we only touched the beginning of this subject. We're going to come back to it. I want to thank Francine Hahn, Betty Schultz, Annette White, and Louise Fink giving up their time to join us this afternoon. Thank you all so much for being in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for writing in and calling in and making the show what it is. We'll come back to this. I want to remind you, the Urbanite unveils the Urbanite Project, its third annual experiment in the power of unconventional collaboration. Urbanite's available in print at over 800 locations around the Baltimore region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com, and they are our print partners. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.